Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, November 3rd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF is supported by Aurora Digital Signage, where images and videos can be instantly uploaded and displayed on multiple screens and at multiple locations, improving communication in hotels, museums, restaurants, manufacturing facilities, retail environments, and school systems. AuroraDigitalSignage.com for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, the area's first green cemetery, plus a conversation and silly questions with Frank Tavares, whose voice can be heard reading the underwriting announcements on NPR.
But first, last week, a University of Arkansas alum returned to campus to present a collaborative project she's involved in, a series of short documentary films portraying the lives and legal struggles that confront those who have been wrongly sentenced to death row. And it was followed by a question-and-answer session. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Megan Garner while she was in town, and Antoinette has this report.
According to the American Civil Liberties Union's website, for every 10 people executed in the United States, at least one is exonerated and released from death row after being wrongfully convicted. It's this statistic that inspired Will Francombe and Mark Pizzi, two London-based filmmakers, to create the One for Ten project. The project is a series of short 5 to 6 minute documentaries that profile 10 death row exonerees. The only U.S.-based member of the team is producer Megan Garner. The University of Arkansas graduate is currently working as a multimedia producer at Education Week in Washington, D.C., but she came to the project while working on her master's degree at the University of Miami. During her research, she came across statistics that show Florida has the second largest death row in the nation, and the state leads the nation in death row exonerees. These two facts stuck with Megan, and she thought, taken together, they were fairly significant.
I kind of started digging in a little bit and started doing some research into the Florida system, which has several factors that make it unique. And I don't know, I just kind of fell down a rabbit hole. I couldn't really pull out of it once I started digging in. And so I started blogging, and through that blog and through kind of immersing myself in looking at the death penalty system, I found out about the One for Ten project, and they were looking for people. And so I got in touch with them, and here we are.
Thanks to the use of crowdfunding, the project received enough financial backing to become a reality. Earlier this spring, Megan and three of her colleagues loaded up into an RV they named Tina and spent 5 weeks traveling more than 5,000 miles across the U.S., interviewing 10 death row exonerees.
We would spend a day filming and do our interview and film some B-roll. Then we would get in the RV and drive to wherever we were going to spend the night that night, usually a KOA, sometimes a state park. And while one person was driving, the other three would start transcribing the interview so that in the morning we could start editing and we would have a transcript to work from. So then the next day we would edit all day long and sometimes late into the night, and then we would have the film finished by the time we went to bed. We'd get up and upload it the next morning and then drive on to the next interview.
Megan explains wanting to make the project interactive for the audience is one of the reasons for the quick turnaround. The crew wanted viewers to be engaged and feel like they were on the journey too. Megan says they wanted the audience to be able to see a film, respond to it, offer feedback, and suggest questions for the next interviewee. Crew members found their interview subjects by working with Witness to Innocence, an organization composed of, by, and for exonerated death row survivors and their loved ones. The group helped the filmmakers find people who were willing to share their story. Each film focuses on a different aspect of being a death row exoneree. The story of Joe D'Ambrosio, for example, shines a light on what life is like after exoneration.
I was on death row for 22 years. I was locked up for 24 years. The Berlin Wall came down. The World Trade Center happened. I lost my sister, my mom, many aunts and uncles, cousins. A lot of them died off when I was in. My sister came down with leukemia, my oldest sister. And we wanted to see if I was going to be a bone marrow match. So I wrote the prison asking if we could do this. They wrote me back and said, "You're a dead man." No. In my eyes, the state murdered her. By putting me on death row for a crime I didn't commit, I couldn't save my sister's life, and she died at the age of 49.
Producer Megan Garner says the story of what happens afterward is so compelling and something that you don't always think about. Even if someone was exonerated because of the internet, people could find out about his or her time in jail, and things like dating, getting a loan or a job, and finding a place to live could become difficult. One of Megan's favorite films tells the story of Damon Thibodeau, which addresses the issue of false confessions.
A lot of people think that you would never confess to a crime that you didn't commit. And Damon says, you know, Damon said the same thing. He said, I never thought that I would confess to something I didn't do. But when they put you in a room and they tell you about, you know, what happens when you're executed, and they tell you that they know it was you, and no one's vouching for you. And, you know, he said, I said anything that I could say to make it stop. So I think it's a really compelling story, and I really like sharing it with people.
Although production has wrapped, effects of the project are still being felt. The website oneforten.com features all 10 films, a map with information about the death penalty in each state, and graphs displaying a variety of information from the race of exonerees to the number of executions per year since 1976, the year the death penalty was reinstated in the U.S. The series of documentary films has been accepted to a handful of festivals, and it recently won Best Web Series at Raindance Film Festival's Web Fest. The next step for the project is to create a feature-length documentary investigating the criminal justice system through the lens of the death penalty. For now, Megan hopes people will use the films in whatever way they find useful. Earlier this week, she returned to Arkansas to discuss the films and says she hopes people will be more aware of issues surrounding the death penalty and have more discussions about it.
I think that 142 people being locked up who shouldn't have been locked up is major. That's major. And the damage is ongoing. I mean, it's not like they get out and they put their life back together. You know, the damage is something that they carry around with them. They have PTSD, they can't date, they have trouble finding jobs. It's just something that alters the course of their lives, and I think that that's important, and it's horrific, and we shouldn't be okay with it. So our justice system is not operating as it should. I think that as a journalist, it's my role to kind of bring attention to that and to try to hold our government accountable to follow, you know, the Constitution. So that's why I think that this is so important.
For more information on this project, you can visit oneforten.com. To read Megan's blog, you can visit punishablebydeath.wordpress.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
After struggling with ethical and organizational issues with being the CEO of American National Bank in Phoenix, Arizona, Tim McFarland says he was lucky enough to be involved with the first ever CEO forum in Phoenix, Arizona, started by Jim Meyer in 1989.
I was fortunate enough to get invited into that original group of 10. I think Jim's probably mentored 200 CEOs over his career in and out of the CEO forums that he built. So I had got to, while I was running a small commercial bank, I got to benefit from the value of the CEO forum.
Tim says that as a business leader, you often don't have anywhere to turn. You're at the top of the organization, and you are the leader. Originally from Arkansas, Tim maintained his ties here, and through business relationships, knew the area could benefit, as he did, from a CEO forum. John Lewis of the Bank of Fayetteville also saw the potential and helped him to form the CEO Forum 1 in Northwest Arkansas in 2006. Though Lewis passed away in 2007, his legacy lives on through the forums and presentations he made, with messages such as "Don't take yourself too seriously" and "Mistakes are opportunities." The CEO Forum is optimal for leaders of organizations who desire continuous growth and, among other things, want to learn from peers and guest speakers about how others solve challenges or optimize opportunities.
We believe that anybody that's in a leadership position ought to find a peer group of people who are peers to them and have a non-competitors, you know, 6 to 10 people, they could gather them however they want to do that and get together every so often to process issues. We believe everybody ought to be in a group, technically.
The CEO Forum consists of monthly gatherings of up to 12 non-conflicting peers and builds upon a safe setting where trust and confidentiality are paramount. CEO Forums in Northwest Arkansas consists of three groups. Each group meets monthly for 3 hours and has one presenter.
And we each process our own individual issue or opportunity. One company or one person each month formally presents their issue. And then we cover a topic maybe sometimes, and we spend that 3 hours going around the room trying to allow everyone to process whatever they might want to put out to the group, that they might want to get some feedback, maybe get some collective wisdom of the group. Sometimes business, as you're running your business, you'll be going around a corner and you don't have perfect visibility, so you can put something out to see if you can learn something from the group, because everybody has different experiences and the group can always help.
The 12 people vary greatly. Today, we meet a lawyer, a sales manager, an engineer at a multi-million dollar manufacturing company, along with the founder of a nonprofit. Each brings something different to the table, but all say they take away diversity in the values presented. Todd Wood is a lawyer and owner of a parking lot maintenance company and a CEO Forum member.
There's such a vast array of experiences. Everybody has just such rich career experiences. But the most amazing thing to me is the emotional quotient that each of them have, the equilibrium with which they approach problem solving and analytics. And when you take the experiences, when you take the candle power that they bring and the emotional equilibrium that they bring, there is just some really wise counsel that comes from each meeting. It's just amazing to see it come about.
It is said that the tears flow from the CEOs at their meetings. Sarah Fennell is the founder and CEO of Restore Humanity, a 501c3 that opened and maintains an orphanage in Kenya, much different from the lawyer we just heard from.
No matter what you're dealing with, we can all relate. So if you can kind of just sit down, everyone treats each other as equals. We sign a confidentiality agreement. So you're sitting in a room full of successful, engaged people, and you can be vulnerable. You can tell them what your issues are. You can hear other people's, and it's a safe, objective environment that it's just helped me in enormous ways. I mean, just through planning and different ideas, and everyone's coming from a different place, but going towards success and going towards being self-starters and things like that. So it's just been an enormous help and great support, great people. I've learned way more than I was expecting.
Sarah has been a member for 1 year after getting her start in an emerging leaders group within the forum, a sponsored group for those in the community that have recognized potential. Gabriel Machado is the sales manager and engineer for Rockline Industries, a multi-billion dollar manufacturer of wet wipes, among other items, with factories worldwide, including Springdale and Boonville. Unlike Todd and Sarah, Gabriel has bosses, but they see the value of investing in their employees.
For me, the greatest value out of this experience is just having this perspective from people that are so generous with their advice. It goes beyond just, to say, your tactical issue that you're trying to tackle, and they are committed in helping you, both at a professional but also at a personal level. So it's just, for me, it's just being able to learn from their experiences and how they handle their own challenges, and being able to gain perspective and apply those learnings to what I'm facing at work. It is really helpful to get perspective out of the day-to-day norm, and that's what I think CEO Forum allows us to do.
For his presentation, Gabriel brought his group to check out how wet wipes are made. Fun fact, in 1 year, Rockline Industries produces enough wet wipes that would wrap around the Earth at the equator 170 times. Since CEO Forums began in Northwest Arkansas in 2006, the group has expanded from just one to include three, plus the emerging leaders groups. Each group meets monthly for member presentations as well as group discussions, like October's topic, the six pillars essential for leading your enterprise. Tim McFarland is the founder and CEO of the CEO Forums in Fayetteville.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Gabriel represents a company that generates over $500 million in annual revenues, and he is in CEO Forum 3 with Sarah, who has a nonprofit with some volunteers, and they help each other out amazingly. You might think that those are real wide, despairing kind of organizations, but it's amazing how each of them can help each other out.
He sees the need and foresees the groups expanding to other areas of Arkansas, including Bentonville and Little Rock. For more information, visit ceoforums.us. This is Ozarks at Large.
There is an effort gaining momentum in Fayetteville toward the creation of more public art. The fundraising event Refresh Fayetteville will take place Sunday night, and it's intended to continue a conversation about the role of public art in the city, as well as raise some money to help fund a couple of specific public art projects, and ultimately, supporters say, help make Fayetteville an arts destination for visitors. Matt Miller, a visual artist based in Fayetteville, has made increasing the amount of public art in the town a priority, and he's been instrumental in putting together the Sunday evening fundraiser at Greenhouse Grill. Last week, I met Matt Miller at his studio, located just off the square in downtown Fayetteville, to talk about the Refresh Fayetteville event. His space is large. He has easels, paint, and works in progress that surround him.
Art and paint and just a big mess pretty much constantly. I try my best, but yeah, there's a lot of art going on, and then lots of creatives just come in and out all day long, and so it's just a constant open conversation of creativity.
The push for more public art sprang out of community-generated meetings, the Fayetteville Forward Initiative and the Creative Economy Action Group. Both bodies were created to be catalysts for community discussion and action. Miller says a recurring theme at the meetings was a strong desire to have the streets, walkways, and other spaces in the city populated with art created for locals by local artists.
So how do we make that happen? And it's just, what I'm starting to find out is you just need to go do it. And you need to talk to the people with the spaces and make sure it's cool with them, show them design, and just make it happen. And not wait on someone to ask you to do it.
Well, the event Sunday night will help raise money to pay for a pair of initial public art projects. Miller says it's just as important to bring the conversation about public art to more people, not just the sculptors and painters who might create the work. To get a conversation started about public art in Fayetteville, you merely have to walk outside of Matt Miller's studio. Within a few minutes walking distance are several examples. Hank Kaminsky's Peace Fountain is in front of the town center. Utility boxes on the square have been turned into works of nature-inspired art by Jason Jones, and nearby storm drains are adorned with local art. And just a few feet from Miller's studio door is a parking garage where he's created panels of art on overhangs that loom over parked cars.
So this is a project that came about specifically just because it's right here outside the studio. I had to look at it every day. People had to look at it every day. And it was just calcium deposits and runoff from the gardens. And it was just like, man, it could be better. And so I'd walk, you know, my landlord is Ed Bradbury, and I just opened that conversation with him, and he was open to it. He's like, just let me see a concept and an idea, and we'll see what we can do. And they were a little afraid of the permanence of it, so I pitched another idea of panels. And so we went with a panel idea so they can be taken down if they ever were to sell it or were to ever want to change it out or do something different.
Miller says since he began trying to engage others in conversations about public art in Fayetteville, the response has been enthusiastic. Several painters have expressed interest in creating their own murals on specific spaces of abandoned buildings or other public places.
I'm like, well, what project do you want to do? And they're like, well, there's this retaining wall that I look at every day that I've been thinking about it. And it's, I'm like, well, we want to help facilitate that and fund it and help fund it. So that's what the fundraiser is all about, is to actually help them realize that dream or that desire.
The fundraiser Sunday night will include live music, food, and a silent auction of items made by local artists. Proceeds will help fuel public artwork in the city's future. Miller has already committed to helping start the movement by putting paintbrush to cinder block.
It will immediately fund a project in Greenhouse Grill's parking lot. There's a building that we've got okayed by the owners. And if you've ever noticed it, if you eat at Greenhouse, it's on the right side. It's just a big cinder block building. And we've been talking with the owners, and they're very open to it. They just want to see what that's going to be. I actually spoke with them today, and they're excited about it.
Another project on the drawing board would be along the Frisco Trail near downtown Fayetteville.
Those are the initial projects we have our hands on. We have people that can do it. We know, but we're very open to any medium. The idea is to get it out there to where it is visible and it stays out there for a decent amount of time would be the idea. But we're definitely open to collaborations and all kinds of stuff. Because who knows where this will take us, which is kind of part of the fun, you know?
Eventually, Matt Miller says he'd like to have pieces of public art all over.
It could be walking around a corner in a garage or whatever. You know, we talked about doing this parking garage below that not too many people go down there, but it would be a sweet spot to have a big positive message or something.
Works of public art, of course, are not always universally loved. Find any city committed to placing art in highly trafficked areas, and you'll find a city that's had at least one highly emotional public debate about the value, message, or quality of a piece of public art. One passersby piece of inspiration is another's dogs playing poker. If a city is serious about dramatically increasing the number of public artworks, how does a group responsible for facilitating those works take into account differences in taste?
That's a good question. I really think you do have to think about it in some sense. You can't just put up anything. You definitely can't do that. That would just be who knows what would happen at that point. Projects we want to be involved with, we want to portray some form of positive message. And as far as that goes, you as an artist, you can't have that fear or that insecurity. You can't let that hold you back from what you feel like you're supposed to do. You have to just move forward and do your best with the project at hand. And what we'll do is people will bring us a project that they want to do. And if it's like, you know, we're like, yeah, that's going to be like 2% of Fayetteville is going to like that. Sorry, we can't fund that. But, you know, come back with something with a positive message and something that might be a little more appropriate for Fayetteville's style and what we're kind of about here. Because you don't want to do something just obscene or abstract that just doesn't make sense in the location. You got to take in all elements. But you can't try to please everyone. That's definitely not possible.
The conversation about the role of public art in Fayetteville is scheduled to continue Sunday night at the event titled Refresh Fayetteville at Greenhouse Grill, beginning at 5. I spoke with Matt Miller last week on the Fayetteville Square.
There are many ways to mark the end of life, from a full funeral ceremony to a wake to cremation. This week, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich filed this story about efforts to create a green cemetery in northwest Arkansas.
We're on a four-wheeler 12 miles southwest of Fayetteville with Vicki Kelly. She's lived out here on the land for 2 decades. She's driving us through the forest on an old trace up the mountain to Droke House.
The 40 acres here is landlocked.
And Vicki Kelly seeks to unlock this estate and transform it into an alternative green burial grounds. Finally arrive at Droke House, a sprawling faux Fayetteville structure built out of wood and stone.
On the top of this house, at the, I guess this would be the east end, is a dome which actually opens across the top and rotates to track the stars.
James Droke was the grandson of University of Arkansas Dean George Wesley Droke, an early 20th century professor of math, logic, and astronomy. He died in the autumn of 1936. James Droke and his wife Kay resided in Arlington, Texas, but vacationed here on this mountaintop estate they named Windcrest, constructed in the mid-20th century. An amateur astronomer, he later built an observatory for use by University of Arkansas research scientists on the north wing of his home, complete with a 16-inch reflecting telescope. The Drokes were childless and willed their estate and observatory to the University of Arkansas Foundation in 1976, transferable upon their death. That occurred 5 years ago, but the house has stood empty for more than 20 years. We climb up into the observatory's equatorial room, the telescope long gone, the dome still intact.
The observatory is only accessible from the exterior of the building. But nothing
feels more womb-like than a circular embrace.
Vicki Kelly envisions families in mourning, gathering here, looking up to the heavens, after laying their loved ones to rest in the earth just down the mountain. We wander through the empty 1960s-era house, walking on original vintage orange floral carpeting, past the kitchen's burnt orange enameled appliances, into the great room. It has a dome ceiling, an immense stone fireplace surrounded by 40 acres of forest.
So many people have shifted in the past generation, and I was one among them. When I lost my son, he was cremated. It was considered sacrilegious by some in my family, but I was very clear that that was a wiser use of green space than traditional burial as we had known it.
The typical casket and hermetically sealed concrete vault surrounding it can take up to as much as 50 cubic feet. So cremation seemed a better option to Kelly until she discovered natural burial.
If you rolled back the sod of a traditional cemetery, you've got a parking lot of vaults over caskets. And it took us a while to get from that model to let's do cremation, wiser use of green space. This is yet the next step.
Vicki Kelly has been an environmental advocate and festival organizer for the past 25 years, but now she's devoting the rest of her life to home death care. And if she manages to get this green cemetery off the ground, the deceased would be prepared by a professional mortician off-premises without embalming fluid, formaldehyde is toxic to the environment, then transported here for final viewing and interment.
This is what we who are desiring to be informed and enlightened and environmentally conscious need to hear, need to give some thought to, need to get our heads around, and move to the natural burial movement.
The former Druk residence and grounds are a perfect sacred space, she says, for natural burial. We walk outside, the sun low on the western horizon, where Kelly points to the future cemetery grounds.
The unique thing about a natural burial is most people assume that, you know, you've heard the term 6 feet under. Well, in natural burial, it's only about 3 foot deep because you want the body to decompose. You want the worms to find you. Now, what's interesting also about a natural cemetery is there are no grave markers. All of the records are kept by GPS points. So you could actually be in China and zero in by satellite and meditate beside grandma's grave because you're going to find it through the GPS systems.
Of course, every green cemetery has its own set of practices, and some do allow grave markers made out of natural local stone. This project, with limited financial resources, Vicki Kelly's looking for both financial investors and donors to purchase the property and plan the cemetery as a nonprofit. The board would hire a manager, gravedigger, groundskeeper, as well as sales and administrative staff. Income would derive from cemetery plot sales as well as special events hosted on the grounds. Her role, Vicki Kelly said, would be a spokesperson, educator, and good neighbor. The Druk estate is currently for sale by the University of Arkansas Foundation, listed as commercial real estate. Vicki Kelly's met with county zoning officials as well as the fire marshal and has been providing tours to interested prospects.
If we're going for the certifications that are awarded by the Green Cemetery Council, we do have to follow certain criteria. And that council says there can be no non-native plants introduced to the landscape. We do not bury in rows. You know, you fit bodies between tree roots and various techniques that make it the least invasive for the natural setting as possible. My actual deep, true heart says, I want to own a couple of mules that pull those bodies in on a wagon. I don't see why we would have to have a hearse do a job in the woods that my team of mules could do, and even working that into the business plan and see if that'll fly, but it's part of my vision.
This would be the first nonprofit green cemetery project of its kind in Arkansas. The first natural burial ground in the U.S. opened in 1998 in South Carolina. Today, 37 have been certified in 23 states, including Missouri. Bowser Family Funeral Home in Mena is the only provider in Arkansas with Green Burial Council certification. In a phone conversation with owner Brian Bowser, he said all funeral homes have historically offered direct burial, no embalming in a decomposing casket. And while certain cemeteries require a concrete vault, no state law mandates it. As for Vicki Kelly, she's joined the National Home Funeral Alliance and is training to become a home funeral consultant, assisting families with staging after-death rituals, filing necessary paperwork, and legally transporting their deceased for natural burial. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. You may not know the name Frank Tavares, but you'll recognize his voice.
This is NPR.
For decades, he's been the voice of NPR's underwriting announcements. He's leaving that job next year, but don't worry, he won't be bored. He's a professor of communications at Southern Connecticut University. He's finishing his first novel, and he's still talking about his first collection of short stories, just published, and titled The Man Who Built Boxes. I recently reached Frank at his home, and I asked him about his passion for writing.
I'm an early morning guy. My wife is too, but sometimes I'm a little earlier than she. And that's the time when I would be alone. So I could get up early, fix myself a cup of tea, a piece of toast, and then sit down in front of the laptop. And if I had some mornings, I might have as much as an hour. Other mornings, maybe 30 minutes, even less. But the idea was to do it. It was as simple as that. I don't manage every single day, but more often than not, and so that's worked for years. But you know something, Kyle, your work habits change. I think back when I was in grad school, my most productive period didn't start till about 10 at night. I couldn't do that now. So you have to pay attention to when is it going to work best for you? When's your most productive time?
The characters in many of the short stories in The Man Who Built Boxes seem to be people, and this is a compliment, seem to be people we know. It's just that we don't know as much about them as we do after we've read your pages. Does that make sense?
Well, this is, thank you for saying that, because that's one of the things that I hope for here. I want to attract readers who are curious about others. I guess it's as simple as that. And so maybe they might see something that resonates with them, a little flash of their own personality or people that they know. And hearing you ask that question, it's like, well, okay, it worked with one person. Maybe it'll work with somebody else. But that's really something that I'm concerned about. I want people to be able to recognize them and to want to know a little bit more about them. Just as I'm hoping that the same thing will happen with the characters. Some of these characters are more curious about where they are in their life at a particular time. And some of the other characters, yeah, they don't care. This is what I'm dealing with now, and okay, what's next? So, yes, thank you for asking that.
Where do the ideas come from? Because each of these stories is different.
It's... yes, that's something that I often wonder about myself. And sometimes it'll come from a snatch of conversation that I hear. And I'll be on the train, and I'll hear just a piece of conversation, people walking past me, and I'll make a little note of that sentence. Or sometimes I carry a little portable audio recorder, or I can use my smartphone, and I'll very surreptitiously repeat what I've just heard, or other times it's I've had a couple of the stories in the book started with the title first, and I found the title was very interesting, and I wanted to know a little bit more about it. One of the stories, there's one story called Accident with a View, for instance, and the first paragraph or so of that story is something that actually I experienced up to a point. The ending of that paragraph, or those first couple of paragraphs, is a little different. I was sitting at an intersection in my car. I drive an SUV, so I'm up a little bit. And the car in front of me at the light, waiting for it to turn green, is a regular sedan, so it's a little lower. And to our left, there's this truck. And I know the truck is blocking the sight lines of the person in the sedan in front of me. And I see out of the corner of my eye, and I turn and I look, and here's some fellow in a hurry, does something really dumb. Just as the light is changing to green, he dashes across the street to make it before the traffic starts. And I see what's going to happen. I see that the driver in front of me can't see him because of the truck, but their timing is going to be just right on the mark, and just as he gets in front of the car is going to take off. And I had this visceral reaction to it. My first instinct was to lean on the horn, and then I thought, no, bad idea, because that'll just make this guy, you know, pull out a little quicker. And I actually yelled into the windshield, you know, no. Now, it ended okay. The guy saw the car starting to pull out. He stopped. Everybody looked at him like he was an idiot, which he was. And it went on, and life was the same. So I said to myself as I'm driving away, literally shaking from watching this, well, I know how this story started. What if it just ended a little differently? Well, let's go find out. And so that's how that particular story began. And other times, like I say, it's a little snatch of dialogue or something else that I've observed. The story that takes place, Antonio's Yard, that starts in this little village in Italy. Last summer, I had a chance to travel to this one city in Italy. It's called the Dying City. I can't remember the Italian name for it. And it's built on this plateau, which is made of not very stable volcanic rock. The city's medieval, so it's hundreds of years old. And literally, parts of this plateau have been crumbling away. And so you're walking through the little streets of this town, and here's this beautiful facade of some 300-year-old building, and then you realize there's nothing on the other side of it. There's just this drop. So I thought of this fellow who lives there, and he wakes up one morning, and part of his backyard is going. And it's not a new thing. And so that's how that story started. So sometimes I'll write that beginning scene. I don't know where it's going. I'll put it aside, and later I'll come back to it.
You mentioned that sometimes the title comes first. I'm going to take a shot at one that maybe had the title before the rest. And it's the first one in the book, My First Ex-Wife's Third Wedding.
Very nicely done.
Yeah.
You're almost correct. The title came almost instantly after I heard that line. And the first line of that story, let me see if I can find it. The first line of the story is, you know, my first ex-wife said, it never occurred to me that I'd be married three times. And I had heard that line spoken, and I'm thinking, that's really interesting. And then the title came very, very quickly after that. And I just said, I love this title. I really like this title, My First Ex-Wife's Third Wedding. I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but it has a nice feel to it. And so you're almost right. You're 75% of the way there.
When you hear someone say something like that,
yes.
Do you allow yourself to actually make a physical note, or do you just have to store it away and hope you remember it?
If I can, I will make a physical note because, you know, good ideas, what's the old expression? Good ideas like pencils get lost. and sometimes I'll mentally store it away, and the first moment I can, I'll just reach for a piece of paper and write it down. Because many times I, at the end of the day or midway through the day, I said, oh, what was that I heard Kyle say this morning? Oh, we were talking on the phone, and I really loved that. Oh, I wish I had written it down. And maybe it'll come back later, and maybe it won't. But I got to tell you, you know, after you hit 30, sometimes it doesn't come back.
The name of the book is The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories. Frank, can I ask you just three quick, perhaps silly questions?
Being a college professor, you know what I'm going to say. There are no silly questions.
Well, let's see.
And so when people log on to Amazon.com and look for The Man Who Built Boxes, and I want them to remember that there are no silly questions when you look at the author bio or the description of the book. If there are questions, they're legitimate questions, and I am willing to answer them.
Okay.
How'd I do? Was that okay? Was that convincing?
Yes, it was.
Well, I meant it.
Well, here is silly question number one.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone up to a counter and asked someone if they sold forever stamps?
You caught me in the middle of drinking water. That was very dangerous. But no, and I'm going to now.
I don't. You got to be careful because that could really mess with somebody, though.
Oh, yes. But I've had people who know me. Some of my colleagues at the university will come by me. I've had this happen to me, I think, on three different occasions. Now, you know they're NPR listeners because somebody will come up to me. I had somebody do this in a meeting with our new dean, as a matter of fact. We're all there, and the meeting hasn't started. And somebody just leaned over to me, behind me, so I didn't see who it was. And they did the line. Mentioned one of the pharmacies sells forever stamps at the checkout counter. And I'm thinking, they're listening.
All right.
Nicely done, Kyle.
Thank you. Silly question number two.
Yeah.
Have people recognized you because of the Capital Cities song that might not have heard you on NPR?
Not yet, but I'm waiting for it. And now we're going to have to tell people. Now we're going to have to tell people about the Capital Cities song.
How did that come about?
The fellows in the group, Capital Cities is a Los Angeles music group, and I got an email from one of them back in the very early spring, or it might have been from their agent, who said basically that they're working on this particular piece and they're trying this little funny idea, and they wonder if I might be open to voicing a couple of pieces of it for them. Well, you're always suspicious when somebody approaches you because, I mean, if somebody tracks me down and asks me if I'd be willing to work on something, I'm very careful about it. There's nothing in my contract with NPR about the work I do with NPR, for instance, that prohibits me from doing other voice work. But because I've been involved with NPR, both part-time and full-time, I was a department head there for a decade, executive producer. I was host of several non-news shows during my tenure there. I'm one of these real passionate public radio fans, and I'm going to be very careful about doing anything that might reflect negatively on my association with NPR and on public radio. So, you know, I'm very leery at first, and they said, well, let us send you a clip of this, and then they voiced some of it. One of the guys in the band voiced what they wanted me to do using different words, and then they pulled a clip of me doing a funding credit someplace and put it in so I could hear how it went against the music. So long story short, I thought, you know, this is going to be fun. And it reminded me, do you remember the Meatloaf song from years ago, Paradise by the Dashboard Light?
With Phil Rizzuto doing the play-by-play.
With Phil Rizzuto doing that little cameo where he does the play-by-play as the characters in the song are basically making out in the front seat of this car. And it put me in mind of that. Well, here's this, one of the artists on this particular CD clip. Did you ever think, Kyle, that you might hear in the same sentence the names NPR's Frank Tavares and hip-hop artist Andre 3000 together? I mean, that's just...
Support for Capital Cities comes from Lazy Hooks. Public Radio.
Silly question number three. Have you ever visited the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation?
I'm really enjoying your silly questions, Kyle. This is really cool. No, I haven't, but I remember when we used to have quite a few credits from Ted and Jennifer Stanley years ago, and then Jennifer Stanley was on the board of directors for NPR for a while, and I was still there when she was on the board. We overlapped, I think, from my full-time association with them, and I did have a chance to meet her a few times, and I remember telling her that aside from her, I was the one that said her name out loud more than anybody else.
Well, Frank, thanks so much. The name of the book, of the short stories, The Man Who Built Boxes and Other Stories, it's out now. You can find it online as well as in bookstores. And then the novel that you're working on, which excerpt, Digging Up Mr. Bradley, any idea when that might come out?
I'm hoping it'll be sometime within a year. I'm hoping that that also will be available at Amazon.com. So pretty soon when you put my name in at Amazon, aside from some of the NPR things that come up and The Man That Built Boxes, there'll be the novel there too. Kyle, it's been a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for letting me share some of your time with your listeners. That's an honor.
We'll chat again when the novel comes out. How's that?
Excellent.
Frank Tavares has been the voice of NPR's underwriting announcements for the past two decades, and his new collection of short stories is titled The Man Who Built Boxes. You can find it at Amazon.com and other sites.
Today, November 3rd, marks the 100th anniversary since the federal income tax was implemented.
That's correct. And so in honor of that, here is a montage, our Sunday montage, dedicated to taxes. And not a surprise, most of the songs that are about taxes are populist movements that don't really like taxes.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. Because I'm the tax man.
Yeah. It's where they pay the taxes, right?
Right.
This money is for the year's assessment on the St. Helena the Blessed Shroud Orphanage in Calumet City, Illinois.
$5,000, it's all there, pal.
I feel so good, come payday. I think of all the things I'm gonna buy when I pick up my pay. Don't you know? Then they hand me that little brown envelope. I peep inside. And Lord, I lose all hope. Cause from them total wages earned down to that net amount that's due, I feel a painful sense of loss between the two.
You're happy because you got nothing. You got nothing in court. You don't got the bookkeeper. You got nothing. Nothing. And if you were a man, you would have done it now. You don't got a thing, you punk.
The tax man's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon.
What did you say?
$35,000.
$35,000?
All of it.
All of it?
Every penny.
You better start making sense.
If you want to keep all that money, give it to your wife. The IRS allows a one-time only gift to your spouse for up to $60,000.
Tax-free?
Tax-free. IRS can't touch 1 cent.
You're that smart banker would kill his wife, aren't you?
While our schools are falling, tell me what in the hell we're paying taxes for. Well, then what do we all stop paying taxes? Now what do we all stop paying taxes? Stop paying taxes, y'all.
You call me traitor?
You? Yes. And every man here who offers you allegiance.
Your Highness.
What else do you call a man who takes advantage of the king's misfortune to seize his power? And now, with the help of his sweet band of cutthroats, you'll try to grind a ransom for him out of every helpless Saxon. A ransom that'll be used not to release Richard, but to buy your way to the throne.
Aha! So in order for this scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
What scheme?
What scheme? Your scheme, you bloody little genius!
I meant no scheme. I merely posed a little academic accounting theory. It was just a thought.
I paid my income tax today. I never felt so proud before to be right there with the millions more who paid their income tax today.
To see if you could identify the 10 clips.
And not the 1040 clips, by the way.
Okay, okay.
Thank you.
Got it. Go to our website, OzarksAtLarge.com.
It is Sunday, November 3rd, 2013. Good morning. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large, and as is our custom, we have Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers with us this morning.
Oh, I'm accustomed.
Is it? Well, is that
can
not,
I be a tradition?
Would tradition be better than custom?
I like tradition. It sounds like we've been doing this longer.
Okay.
We've been doing this a long time now.
As is our great pleasure most Sundays. Here is Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. How's that?
That's wonderful.
Yes.
To talk out my ear like I did the other day. This time we're going to make up stuff about the Marshalls Museum in Fort Smith.
We're going to make stuff up.
No, we're actually not going to make
Kyle's
stuff up.
Very interested in the Marshalls Museum.
Yes.
So
what
he's our expert.
Okay. One of our reporters, Lorinda Jinks, went down to talk about the fact that they're going to do a cornerstone placing this coming weekend. Well, she loves stuff like that. So she came back with an 80-inch story to fit in a 35-inch hole. If you have any concept of measurement, you don't need to understand newspapering to know a lot of it went on the cutting room floor.
More than twice what was allotted.
Exactly. But she talks about how this will be the only museum honoring the U.S. Marshals Service in the country.
Right.
And that it will honor also present-day marshals who do a lot of the things you see on TV. But in the early days of actually Van Buren was the bigger city.
Right.
Instead of Fort Smith. And in the early days, it was the Hall of Justice where the marshals went out into Indian territory and brought back the bad guys.
I mean, vast, vast land west of there.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of the things they're going to do is have a trial that is a recreation of an actual case will take place at the Fort Smith National Historic Site in Hanging Judge Isaac Parker's courtroom. It's about the Lee Gang, who stood trial for the murder of four lawmen who died trying to arrest the two brothers, Jim and Pink Lee, and they were found innocent.
Spoiler alert.
So we'll see what the modern jury decides.
Oh, okay.
They said
okay.
They've never had, we often have a hung jury, but we haven't reached a conviction in years. They say.
Well, I mean, the evidence is a bit old in these recreations.
Well, that's
after
true.
All, and the witnesses are gone.
And there's almost no DNA.
Right. Right.
Anyway, on November 8th and 9th, you can start at 8 o'clock on November 8th with a lecture on the Going Snake Massacre and continue through 6:30 on November 9th when there is the last night court presentation. All of this happening all around that area. The laying of the cornerstone is at 11 o'clock on Saturday the 9th, and you can find out more at usmarshalsmuseum.com.
And you can find out more about the timeline for the Marshall Museum creation, things like that.
Which they're going to break ground next year, so it'll happen soon. Also this afternoon, there's a Barbershop Harmony concert.
I love Barbershop.
Presented by the Greater Ozarks Chapter of the Barbershop Harmony Society and featuring Vocal Spectrum from St. Charles, Missouri, and Premium Blend of Springfield. And this happens at 2 o'clock at the Bella Vista Community Church. Tickets are $15. Dale Gagne is back in town.
Yes.
For the Live on Stage in Northwest Arkansas series. 2 o'clock this afternoon at Arend Art Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $25. And the last performance, the last little bit of Halloween. You could squeeze out the last zombie. Zombie High School Homecoming at 2 o'clock at Arts Life Theater in Fayetteville, and tickets are $6 to $8.
All righty. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Hinesville.
Okay. Just close to me by Goshen. Yep.
Yep.
Do want to say a thank you to everyone who called or went online to donate to KUAF during our fall on-air fundraiser. If you missed out, you can still make a pledge or donation at our website, supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
Antoinette has the show tomorrow at noon. Ozark's larger production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks for listening.